All right, we're beginning here on the bottom of Memom and Bet by the Mishnah on the new Perek. Perek begins, Kol Atzlamim Atzurim. All types of idols are problematic. Mipnei Shehem Nevadim Pamachat V'Shana. Because they are worshipped at least once a year. Divrei Rabbi Meir. That's Rabbi Meir's position. As to what the meaning of Kol Atzlamim here is unclear, whether it means, according to some Rishonim, just Tzlamim of human beings, of people or persons, that would be problematic. Or does it mean Kol Atzlamim means any type of idol, any type of image that is made would be problematic. You can see if you look in the Rabbeinu Chananel, and the last line he says, based on the Gemara later on, he says, Klomar Tzurat Adam. One of the qualifiers of the Amoraim in the Mishnah is that we're only speaking about a human Tzelem, but that would imply that the reading of the Mishnah without that qualification would have been Kol Atzlamim means literally any Tzelem. And this Amora is coming to narrow the scope of the Mishnah. So that would imply that any Tzelem would be problematic, because they are worshipped once a year. That is the view of Rabbi Meir. V'chachamim omrim, ein asur, ela kol sheyesh biyado makel, o tzipor, o kadur. That they're only types of avodah zarah when they have a specific item in their hand, which is either a staff, a bird, or a ball. Any one of those items would then deem it to be avodah zarah. And the Gemara will speak about what the significance is of each of these items. The Chachamim disagree, as we'll see in the Gemara. They can't be arguing about a practical issue as to whether they do or don't worship them once a year, because then the wording of the Chachamim should have been different, as Rashi points out. It should have just said, "B'chachamim omrim enu nevat." It's not worshipped. That's not what they say. They say it's "Chachamim omrim enu asur." It's only asur when this happens. And therefore, the Gemara is going to determine that the machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim is to the extent that we worry about these issues. Obviously, there are some that are worshipped in this way. Question is, what are the implications of that? And that's what the Gemara will deal with. But Shimon ben Gamliel omer, af kol sheyesh biyado kol davar. As long as it has something in its hand, that already means that there's significance to this tzelem, to this idol, to this image or statue. And therefore, it would be problematic for avodah zarah. So here we're dealing with what seemingly is Rabbi Meir's Shita that we saw in the previous parak. That's what the first Amora says in the Gemara. Idem nevadim pamachat b'shana, my time the Rabbonon. What's the reason behind the Rabbonon? If they are worshipped once a year, why does it matter whether it's once a year, twice a year, every day? They're avodah zarah. If it's avodah zarah, the Chachamim should agree to the position of Rabbi Meir. As we noted before, they can't be arguing fundamentally about whether they are or not worshipped, because then the Chachamim just should have said, Enu Nevad. They don't worship these types of idols. The fact that they are, say, Enu Asur, means that they agree that the idols are worshipped, but it's still not Asur. So I'm Rabbi Yisrael, Bar Yosef, I'm Rabbi Yochanan, Bim Komosha, Rabbi Meir, Yuvdim Ota Pamachat Bashana. In Rabbi Meir's location, that was the practice, that they worshipped them once a year. Rabbi Meir, Achayish Limiuta. Similar to what we saw back on Daf Lamed Daled, by the Gvinei Beit Onyeke, those cheeses that came from that occasion, Rabbi Meir worried about the meal. He is worried when there is a minority that has this problem. Do we then extrapolate that and say we have to worry about the majority in that case? The case of Beit Onyeke, we remember we said that the majority of calves in that area were used for avodah zarah. Therefore, if they were curdling the milk in the kebah of that animal, it would be problematic. Even though the majority of animals were not avodah zarah, the majority of calves were. So for Rabbi Meir, that was a miut that was significant enough for you to extrapolate it and say, we're going to be oser, all cheeses from that location. Come and say, we're not choshesh the miut. It's a minority, we're not going to worry about it. And again, we saw over there that Rabbi Meir says that if it's an insignificant minority, we're not going to worry about it. If it's a minority of a minority, then we're clearly not going to worry about it. And same with the Chachamim. Again, once you reach a level of significance, I think that they would consider that something to worry about. So you're dealing with certain levels of a minority where it has some significance to it. Question is it significant enough to then extrapolate from it? So what the suggestion is here is the Machloket in the Mishnah is, in Rabbi Meir's location, this was the practice. The Chachamim don't disagree that that was the practice. Their disagreement is about whether we then are gozer on all Tzlamim because of the Tzlamim in Rabbi Meir's location. Do we extrapolate that to other areas? And you can see that in the Balei HaTosafot, He says that over here in this location, you have to say that it has to be that everybody was worshiping all the idols or statues that were there once a year. Because otherwise, you're going to run into the same problem we ran into over there, which is then you're going to have a minority of a minority, which is that Rabbi Meir only says the cheeses of Beit HaMikdash are a problem. He does not say cheeses from other locations are a problem. The reason being is that he agrees that within that city, still the majority of animals are not used for Avodah Zarah. If you add on top of that the whole world, then it becomes a majority of the whole world's animals. They become a very insignificant minority, and then you wouldn't worry about it. So Rabbi Meir by the Gvinot only extends it to the city itself. It doesn't extend it beyond the city. Here, he's saying any statue, any image is problematic. The only way you could do that is to say that in his location, everybody worshipped at least once a year these statues. And now the extrapolation is to the rest of the world. So you're a minority vis-a-vis the rest of the world, but you're not a minority in the location. Had you been a minority in the location, then you couldn't extrapolate that to the rest of the world. Maybe to that location you could extrapolate it, but not to the rest of the world. So that's how it's different than what we saw in the previous parak. But that would be the explanation here of the Machloket, which is, gazar sharmikamot atu oto makom. He goes there, the rest of the world, because of that location. They don't worry about it. Minority, they do not establish a restriction based on some minority in the way that Balei Tosfot explained it. It's not minority dislocation, but it's the minority in the world. This is an unusual place. Just because this place is unusual, we're not going to extrapolate to other places. Whereas Rabbi Meir says, well, if this is the full practice in this place, then we should worry about at least possibilities of this happening in other places that people are worshiping these items. Alright. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Ben Darti Shel Melachim Shaninu. We're talking about a statue to the king. Over here you have a multi-layered machloket about this, which is, which king are we speaking about? And then, if we're speaking about the king, what is this statement qualifying? Is it, first of all, arguing on the previous suggestion? Amar Rav Yitzchak by Yosef Rabbi Yochanan. And number two is, then, is it defining or qualifying the Rabbonon, or is it qualifying Rabbi Meir? So we'll start with Rashi Shita. Rashi says, Andarti kasha melech meit. After the king passed away, osim tzurato v'petach hashar l'zikaron. They used to make a statue of the king at the entranceway to the city, or the entranceway to different locations, as a memory to the king who passed away. V'haltam ka'asa Rabbi Meir, agav chavivuta palchilei. Rashi makes it clear in the answer to the questions that we raised. First of all, this is a king who passed away already. It's an image to his memory. Number two is that this is qualifying Rabbi Meir and not the Chachamim. And number three is that because they love the king so much, that after his passing, not only do they give reverence to the king with this statue, they also worship the statue. So according to Rashi, what's happening here is we're now narrowing significantly the scope of where Rabbi Meir is oser. Rabbi Meir is not just oser everywhere. He's only oser, according to Rashi, in cases where you're dealing with a statue of the king that's passed away, and it's at the shahr, it's at the entranceway to the city, and it's a, as the Rabbeinu Kanano says, surat adam, we're only speaking about a human image now, statues of human image. In that case, Rabbi Meir says there that we're choshesh for avodah zarah. So there'll be a very narrowed scope, and clearly he's arguing on the previous statement, Rabbi Yitzchak for Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yochanan, who said that Rabbi Meir was choshesh the miut, but there it seemed to me there was no limit to where we are choshesh the miut, any statue, any image. Here we have a significant limitation as to when Rabbi Meir thinks this is a problem. And then we have another statement, which is, Amar Rabba Barchana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Omdim al petach medina shaninu. We're speaking about when they're at the entranceway to the city. Amar Rabba, Machloket b'shel kfarim. That is true in the villages. Aval b'shel krachim, in the major cities, divrei hakol mutarim. Everybody would agree that it's fine. My taima, lenoi avdei luhu. Because they do it as a decorative image. They do it as part of the aesthetics or the presentation of the city. As you enter, there they have the statue of the king. That's part of the what cities do. They put up something significant as a indication of who their loyalty is to, or to have people see something nice when they're coming in. When you're speaking about the kfarim, how could you have a machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim as to whether people do this for decorative purposes? They can't afford it. The kfarim, They're definitely worshiping it because they don't have the money to expend. A village that puts up a statue at the entrance to the village would only expend that money if it was something significant religiously. If it wasn't something significant religiously, they don't have the wherewithal to pay for images or statues like that. Ella, itmar hafi itmar. If you want to explain the machloket, you'd explain it this way. Amarava machloket b'shel krochim. The machloket between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim is in the major cities. Aval b'shel kfarim, divrei hakol asurim. But in the villages, everybody agrees. Even the Chachamim agree, if they put up a statue and invest that type of money in a statue, they're definitely worshiping the statue, because otherwise they wouldn't expend that type of money. In the city, you can ask questions about why they're putting in a statue. They have the wherewithal, they have the means to do it. Are they putting it in because it's a avodah zarah? Are they simply putting it in as a decorative part of their entranceway to the city? So that's the way that Rashi explains it. Again, there are three different points made by Rashi in this part over here. Number one, that we have a machloket here versus the first explanation of the Mishnah. First explanation of the Mishnah was Rabbi Meir's chayish lemiyuta. And then Rabbi Meir worries about all types of tzlamim because they worship them once a year. Never extrapolates that to all tzlamim and says they are problematic. Here we have a very significant narrowing of that scope, saying that it's only applicable to andarte shel melachim. It's only applicable to, first of all, human images of the king that passed away. And here we have the machloket between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim, and that's even more significantly narrowed by Rabbi Bar Chana, Rabbi Yochanan, ve'omdim al petach medina she'ninu, that they're standing at the entranceway to the city, which is, here's an additional qualification, which is that only when they're standing at the entranceway to the city do we worry about the possibility that this is avodah zarah, because there it's given significance, both from the standpoint that it could be aesthetic, or from the standpoint that it could be a avodah zarah. But once you're speaking about in the entranceway to the city, that's where you have a machloket. When you go into the kfarim, everybody agrees that it's problematic. And even in the major cities, we're only speaking about at the entranceways, where it would have been something of significance. And that's where they argue about whether it's noy or not noy. Here you could see the possibility that Amar Rabba Bar Chana was arguing. Although then, as we know in Shas, this is a good thing to know, then if Rabba Bar Chana was arguing, then the Memra would have read Rabbi Rechanim Rabbi Yochanan Amar, that the Amar would have come after his name. That indicates he's arguing on the previous position. When you have Amar in the beginning of the position after an Amar, that means that they're not necessarily arguing. You can see that in the Hagota Gra. If you look in the Hagota Gra, Ot Aleph, he says, Nir ve'enai girsat Rambam. The Rambam had a different girs over here. Rabbi Rechanim Amar Rabbi Yochanan ve'omdim. He does not stare out the phrase with Amar, but rather has Rabbi Rechanim Amar Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Upalig al Shmuel. And he argues on Shmuel. According to the Rambam, the Rabbi Bar Chana's statement is an argument against Shmuel's position. And he says, forget about it, Darte Shel Melachim. He just says that it has to do with whether it's in the entrance to the city or not. If you have a statue at the entrance to the city, it's problematic. That's where Rabbi Meir was speaking. But not in general, he wasn't making a comment. But Shar Poskim, Mifrashim de Lo Plige. The remainder of the Mifrashim say they don't argue. And they go explain it within the view of the Rabbanan, not like Rashi. Now Rashi said it in the view of Rabbi Meir. But here you have what we call it like a double qualification of Rabbi Meir's position according to Rashi. The Rabbeinu Tam takes issue with Rashi on each of these points. And the Rabbeinu Tam says, first of all, the Andarte that we're speaking about here is not about someone who passed away already, but rather, Perish Tzurat Shilton Achai, Usim Lichvodo. Speaking about the king who is the current king, and in those cases, sometimes they put up an image or a statue to the honor of the king, and he brings examples of that. First of all, we have that with the Andarte of Nebuchadnezzar, and we also find that the Gemara speaks about Adrianus Caesar put up an Andarte that was for his own image or in his own image. And so here you see that these types of Andartot were specifically put up as images for the current leader, not for the past leader. So that's the first thing that Rabbeinu Tam argues on. In the next Tosafot, he says that Rashi explains this as qualifying the position of Rabbi Meir, and he gives a whole slew of reasons why you would think otherwise. L'kach peirush Rabbeinu Tam, d'hochokaya hatera d'rabbonon, that the qualification here is not on when Rabbi Meir makes it asur, but rather on when the Chachamim say it's mutar. V'achik amar, had sharu abonon b'matnitin, here where the Rabbanon and our Mishnah say it's mutar, that's only true when we're speaking about an image of the king. And it's also standing at the entranceway to the city. So Rashi thinks that the entranceway to the city is a place where it's more likely to be worshipped because that's a place of significance. That's a place of honor, and that's why they would worship it over there, because qualifying Rabbi Meir's statement, whereas the Rabbeinu Tam, who believes that it's qualifying the Rabbanan, then the entrance to the city is the place where it would be Lanoi. That's where we would assume that it's the least likely to be worshipped, because that's the most likely place to put it if you're just putting it there for something that is aesthetic. So in this way, the Rabbeinu Tam shifts the Machloket in a totally different direction, which is that, according to Rashi, and Darti now comes to narrow the scope of where Rabbi Meir says it's Asur. That means that the Chamim think that it's Heter all over the place. And then Rabbi Meir has a small subset where there's an Isur, which is the statue of the king. Of course, Rashi, the king that passed away. And only at the entranceway to the Medina. That's it. Those are the only places Rabbi Meir is going to worry. Now then, Rabbi Tam says, first of all, we're speaking about a live king. And that's who the statue is to. And number two is, we're speaking about the Rabbana, not Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir is Oser everything. The Chamim who say that we're not Oser, that's only true by an Andarta to the king, where it's at the entranceway to the city. In that case, the Chamim say they're not making a statue to worship it. That's just a statue in honor of the king, or in honor of the ruler at that time. And so therefore, the Chamim say, you know when I disagree with you, Rabbi Meir? When it's a statue of the king at the entranceway to the city, and it's not holding anything in its hand. That's when it's Mutar. Because then we say it's Lanoi. It was decorative in nature. Anything else would be Asur. That means that the Chachamim basically believe almost everything is Asur with the exception of this. And they're much closer to than Rabbi Meir and this idea that everything is Asur with the exception of these items which they think are Heter. So that's the way that the Rabbi Nutam reads it. The Ramban brings a possibility that the Rif reads this as a qualification of both positions. The statement here is qualifying both Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim's position. That means Rabbi Meir was only Oser in cases of Andartot, where it was some image that was for the king. And in addition, the Chachamim also, they were only Oser when there's a Makel or some sort of item in its hand, and in case of an Andarti. So that would be that it's modifying or qualifying both of their statements in the Mishnah, and that they both only spoke in this case. That means that all Tzlamim in general are fine. Only the Andarti is where Rabbi Meir thinks it's Asur. And the Chachamim as well, when they say that it's a sur, when there's a makel or a kadur or something else in the hand, that's only uniquely associated with Andarti. But it applies to both of them, unlike Rashi, who thinks it only applies to Rabbi Meir, and according to the Rabbeinu Tam, who thinks it only applies to the Rabbanon. Now, the Yushalmi does have a qualification that the Balei Tosfot brings. Yushalmi says there's a difference between the Melech and the Shilton, which is that when you're speaking about the local ruler, there's no question that whatever's put up is put up for their honor, and nobody's worshiping the local ruler. If you're talking about the Caesar, then everybody worships the Caesar. What we're speaking about in the Machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim is what lands in between. When we have something where it's not clear what the tselem was made for. When you have a sam tselem, is that made the shilton or is that made the melachim? And that difference will be the machlok between Rabbi Meir and the chachamim. So that's the way that the Yushalmi defines it. Right now, the Gemara continues. Chachamim omrim einan asurim makel. So what are the meaning of all these items that are being held in the hand of the Avodah Zarah that makes us feel that those are definitely being worshipped? So the answer is makel. If it has a staff in its hand, shirodeh etatzmo, Tachat kol olam kulo kemakel. He beats himself as if he's under the burden of the world itself. Clear here that the Gemara is using a lashon genai, which is just the opposite of what it means. It means that if he has a staff there, that he's using his staff to beat down the world or to rule over the world. Gemara just posits it in a negative light. He's under the burden of the world, or the world is beating him with the staff, because obviously they're denigrating the Avodah Zarah, but the meaning is just the opposite, and you can see that in the Rabbeinu Chananel, who gives explanation to each one of these items, which he says, Makel, Klomar, hu rodeh et ha'olom kulo b'makel. He beats the world, and he rules over the world with his staff. Now the next one, which is, Tzipor, shetofes et atzmo tachat ha'olom kulo k'tzipor. He puts himself under the whole world like a bird. And again, here, the way that the Rabbeinu Chananel explains it is, Tzipor shetofes ha'olom kulo b'yado, it's as if he's holding the whole world in his hand, like you grab a bird and you can hold on to a bird. He's holding on to the whole world. I would have explained it slightly differently, which is just like the bird has a bird's eye view of the world, the one who's holding the bird indicates that he has a bird's eye view. He's the one overseeing the whole world. And then the kadur is, so face it, that small tachat olam kuloki kadur. places himself under the world like a ball. And if you look in the Rabbeinu Kananan again, Kadur Nami Sholom Kolo Biyado Kamo Kadur Bidei Adam. Just like he has a ball in his hand, so too he has the whole world in his hand. Although, if you look in the Bayit Tosafot, he says something very interesting. He says, Sha'olam Agul, the world is round. And given that the world is round, he's holding on to the world in his hand. Now it's interesting, given the time period of the Bayit Tosafot, it's a time period where there's a heavy shift back to belief in the world being flat rather than round, and that only the trips of Magellan and others at that time disproved the fact that it is a flat world. Originally, that seemed to be the way that people thought. If you look at the views of Ptolemy, they seem to indicate that the world is round. And again, that shift back to a flat earth happens later on in the Dark Ages, as they call them, where they went back to this old thinking that it was flat instead of round. So depending which Bayit Tosafot you're speaking about, how early or late that is, it's pretty revolutionary that they're suggesting here that the ball in the hand means that it's a round world, and that might be what's being held in the hand of the individual. So now, Tana, Husifi Alem, they added on to them, Saif, a sword, Atara, a crown, Vitabat, and a ring. So each of these items also would be indication of dominion of some sort. Saif, the sword, Mi'ikara, Sabor, Listim, Bahama. They thought originally they were just a bunch of thieves or marauders, meaning that the sword was an indication of his military prowess. It was an indication of this warrior of some sort. And the stima again here would be Lashon Genai, which is, it's making fun of the item that he's, as if he's a marauder. But obviously it means that someone who has some sort of military prowess. But the Gemara terms as listim in a negative term. Sof Savar Shoreget Atzmo Tachat Kol Olam Kulo, that he kills himself under the whole world. Again, this Lashon Sagi Nohor, that he carries a sword to the world. He's trying to kill out the world. Atara, the crown. Mi kavar sarvor gedil klile. In the beginning, they thought it was just like a woven wreath. It was a type of honor that you put, or something that was honorable, but not something that indicated dominion. It was just simply decorative in nature, or even jewelry that they would wear to indicate their position. But that doesn't mean that you think they are avodah zarah. So they just thought it was gedil klile ba'alma. And Rashi says over here that gedil klile means uman, samli atara, the artisan, the one who made the statue, just happened to put a crown over there. It was a nice thing to do. Ulusov sabor katara la melech. Then at the end they realized that it was an indication of dominion in the sense of, I'm ruling over the world, or you have the crown in your hand. Tabat, so this is minyana d'yoma. Tabat mikara savar ishtaima ba'alma. That it was simply an indication that he was a messenger. The king removed his ring or his signet because that was the stamp that was used to indicate that this was a decree of the king. Just like in Megillat Esther, the king takes off his ring and gives it to Haman in order to give Haman power. Doesn't mean that Haman's the king. Just means Haman is now authorized to do things in the name of the king. He's a shliach of the king in that way. And vice versa, when the ring is given to Esther and Mordechai, they're also acting as proxies for the king. So you would have thought it was just a messenger or proxy for the king. Whereas if you look in the Rabbeinu Kanano, he translates it, Perishishtima apichopa mimune ala utzarot. That is, the person who's in charge of all the treasuries, v'chutam nikra ishtima. And the seal or signet itself is called the ishtima, because he was the one who controlled the treasuries. And that's what we were thinking that it meant. That's what the signet was indicative of. The whole world is signing him to death under them. Again, it's Lashon Sagi Nohor, which means that he is the determiner of who lives and who dies. He signs or he seals the fate of all individuals. And therefore the ring is a sign of avodah zarah in that way. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel in the Mishnah says that anything in the hand is considered to be avodah zarah. Tana afilu tzror, afilu kisam. Doesn't matter here if you have a pebble or a little splinter in the hand, that is considered to be avodah zarah. And that would represent somehow that the whole world is in his hand, or whatever item is in his hand, is indicative of the power or the control that this idol holds. By Rav Ashi, tafas v'yado tzoa mahu. He's holding excrement in his hand. Is that considered, like the Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, to be avodah zarah? Already, is that already some sort of denigration of sorts that you would not consider avodah zarah? Mi'aminin kuliyama zilu ba'ape kitzoa. How do you interpret the fact that he has excrement in his hand? Is it that everybody in his eyes is like Zoa? Oh, Dilma, who, miho, dezil, be'apet, kuleyama, kitzoa? Is it that everybody looks at him like Zoa, like excrement? Or does he look at everyone else like excrement? And that'd be the difference. If you think that his holding excrement is an indication of how he looks down is such a great power that everybody else is insignificant in his presence, then that would be Avodah Zarah. On the other hand, if you see it as a denigration towards the Avodah Zarah itself, then obviously it wouldn't be Avodah Zarah. It would be an indication of people's displeasure or the lack of respect for this item. And Teiku, that we leave as unresolved as to what the meaning is in that situation. So now the next Mishnah. Amotzei Shivrei Tzlamim. Person who finds pieces of a Tzelem. Harielu Mutarim. These are okay. Matzat Tavnit Yad. Otavnit Regel. You find a hand or a regal or a foot, because they worship these types of items. And Rashi explains what the Gemara is about to explain in a second, which is that these are sveika. That there's a double sveik here, and that's why we go to kula. Because if you have shleimim, we don't even know when they were whole whether they were worshipped or not. Then, after they're broken into pieces, how do you know why they were broken into pieces? Even if they were worshipped while they were whole, when they were broken to pieces, maybe they were mevatel, the Avodah Zarah, because it broke, or they broke it. So you have a double sefek over here, and that's why we're going to be matir, or go lekula, sfek sfeka lekula. That is the concept behind this Mishnah. Now, from this Mishnah, as well as the first Mishnah, it's pretty clear that what we're speaking about, Tzlamim, in these cases, we're speaking about these statues or these images that are being found out somewhere. We don't know whether it's in the field, entrance to the city, wherever these items are found. We're not speaking about something that's found inside a Beit Avodah Zarah. If you find an image inside the Beit Avodah Zarah, you can pretty clearly conclude that that is Avodah Zarah, and there's nothing to speak about in those instances. If they break, then there may be something to speak about. If you're talking about Tzlamim, there's going to be no argument that when it's found in the house of worship or the house of Avodah Zarah, there's a problem. The questions that are being dealt with here with the Mishnayot are images or statues that are found in other locations besides the places of worship. If you dedicate a temple to this god or that god, then the images in there are problematic, period. If it's found at the entrance of the city, now you have a question. What's the purpose? What's the nature of that item that's found there? That's number one. Number two is the Gemara is going to make a distinction over here between Shivrei Tzlamim and Shivrei Avodat Kochavim, which is, are we dealing here with pieces or broken pieces of a statue, like Rashi says, where there's a sveik, and therefore we say the kula. Or is it, this din also true when you find broken pieces of Avodah Zarah? Once they are broken into pieces, is that already an indication that they have been vatalit? They no longer think of this as a god, and the logic being, and Shmuel will stipulate this in a second, that if it can't take care of itself, how's it going to take care of me? And if that's the case, then there would be no significance anymore to these items because they're broken pieces and the goy is mevatel it. The third thing you need to know is that bitul avodah zarah can only be done by a goy. If a goy worshipped avodah zarah, he can be mevatel the avodah zarah. A Jew, Israel, cannot be mevatel avodah zarah. If he worships the avodah zarah remains permanently problematic. So you have to assume in all these cases we're not speaking about Israel that worshipped it. And again, that would be in an insignificant minority when you're talking about these statues, that there were Jews worshiping the statues. So that's not going to be the concern that we have, but you just need to know that we're speaking about non-Jewish worship and then non-Jewish bitul or nullification of that. So now Shmuel comes along, qualifies the Mishnah and says, Amar Shmuel, afilu shivrei obadat kochavim. The Mishnah, when it says shivrei tzlamim, doesn't literally mean shivrei tzlamim. It even means shivrei avodah zarah. Not only do we say it by a sfek sfeika, but even by a sfek, we're going to say it because our assumption is that people don't worship broken pieces of idols. And therefore, we find it broken and smashed, you can assume that it was mevutal, and there's no problem of avodah zarah anymore. Banan tanan. The obvious question to ask on him is the Mishnah. The Mishnah says shivrei tzlamim. Why doesn't the Mishnah just say that it's Shivrei Avodat Kochavim? That'd be a bigger Kiddush. The answer is, Hu Adin. Tafilu Shivrei Avodat Kochavim. It's true also of Avodat Kochavim, Adetani Shivrei Tzlamim. So then why does it say Shivrei Tzlamim in the Mishnah? Mishum Dekobabai, the Mitna Seifa. It's going to teach you the latter half of the Mishnah there where there is a Kiddush. Matzah Tavnit Yad, Tavnit Regel. You find an image of a hand or a foot. Harielu Asurim. Those are problematic. Because they are worshipped. So now, what he's suggesting is, had you written the Mishnah in the following manner, which is, Hamotzei Shibrei Avodat Kochavim Harilu Mutarim, that would be mutar, but if you find a hand or a regel, that would be a sur. That would be solely relegated to a Shivrei Avodat Kochavim. That would mean that if you read the Mishnah that way, if I came across Shivrei Tzlamim, that were a hand or a foot, they'd be totally mutar according to that reading of the Mishnah. That's why Shmuel says the Mishnah didn't do that. The Mishnah had written Shivrei Avodat Kochavim, you would think Shivrei Tzlamim are mutar always. There's nothing that's a sur. The Mishnah says Tzlamim in order to teach you the second half of the Mishnah, which is Shivrei Tzlamim. If they're a foot or a hand, those are problematic. So that's the Chiddush of the Mishnah, and that's why he wrote it about Tzlamim. Even though it should have written Avodat Kochavim in the first half, it wrote Tzlamim because of the second half of the Mishnah. Now, even though in general we have a belief that Koach Dehetera Odif, that generally when it comes to a Mishnah has to make a decision whether to emphasize the Heter or emphasize the Isur, it will emphasize the Heter. Over here, the Baalei Tosfot said, Yesh Lomar Dekan, Vaday Koach the Isura, the Tavnid Yagarel, the Tzlamim Adif. It makes more sense to put the Isur in here. Kitam gadol ayenu lehatir. There's a good reason to be matir, even a foot or a hand of a tzelem. If you just have a statue now that's broken into pieces, and now you have a foot or a hand left over, there's strong reason to believe that there should be no isur at all. And therefore, the bigger chiddush in the Mishnah is to say those are asurim. And that's why the Mishnah left the heter side and went to the isur side. That's a much bigger chiddush. To say that the broken pieces of Avodat Kochavim are mutar, that is a bigger chiddush than saying Tzlamim, but it's still not outside the realm of what you would have thought without the Mishnah, because you would just assume Bittul, and that would have been fine. On the other hand, when you have a hand or a foot, why would you ever think a statue that's broken into pieces that has a hand or a foot there, why would you think that's still a sur? And that's the chiddush of the Mishnah according to Shmuel. Now the Gemara quotes the Mishnah and says, Tanan, Matzah Tavnit Yad, Tavnit Regel, Harei Yalu Surim, Minei Shvukiyotzi Bo Ne'abad. That those are considered to be problematic because things like that are worship. Amai, why would you think that Vahashvarim Ninu? These are broken pieces. So this question could either be on the Mishnah as a whole. The Gemara is asking on the Mishnah, why is it that the Mishnah says that these are Asurim? These are broken pieces. And the Havamita would have been that these are just nullified pieces of Avodah Zarah, whether they are Avodah Zarah or not. They've been nullified and we're done with them. Why would you think that there's any problem with that at all? So that could be a generic question on the Mishnah, or it could be a question on Shmuel's understanding of the Mishnah. Shmuel just said the Mishnah specifically wrote this in this manner to tell you that the Tzlamim, that even by statues, a foot and a hand are problematic when there's a piece of them left. I was going to say, am I? Why would you think that a foot or regal of a statue should be problematic? If the whole statue is questionable when it's there, then certainly when it's broken to pieces, even if it's a hand or a regel, there's no reason to believe that this should be problematic. And that's the Amaya and Shmuel. Why is the Mishnah focusing on this Chiddush when it seems that there's no reason to make it a sur at all? Because Lulei Divrei Shmuel, had it not been for Shmuel, as the Baalei Tosfot will point out, you could have explained the ratio of the Mishnah speaking about Tzlamim, and the latter half of the Mishnah speaking about Avodah Zarah. And that will explain the difference between the Shvarim of the ratio and the Tavnit Yad V'Regel in the latter part of the Mishnah. Or, according to Shmuel, believes that anytime you see a broken Avodah Zarah, then we have to assume it didn't happen by itself, but it was actively done, then why should there be any difference between what pieces are left over if it's done actively? In any case, it's done actively, even the smallest piece is knocked off, and the whole statue is still there, that's a bittul, because the person destroyed it or broke it in some fashion, some way or some fashion. And so that's why the question really revolves around Shmuel, it's not just a general question about the Mishnah. My answer is Targuma Shmuel. Shmuel explained it. That's why it's a question of whether it's a question on Shmuel or it's a question on the Mishnah. Could be it's a question on the Mishnah and Shmuel's just explaining it. Or Shmuel's explaining his own position in the Mishnah, which is Be'omdim al-Bisisan. They're standing on their base. Rashi over here says al-Bisisan al-Kanan. Makom ha-Miktukama timdo dvino hatam vaday palchiluhu. So the way that he explains it according to the Baalei Tosafot, is they have something called a bimus. A bimus is something we bumped into early in the Masechta, and that's where the Baalei Tosafot disagree with Rashi about the meaning of what a bimus is, and they pointed to this Gemara over here as to their disagreement as to what this bimus means. Because Rashi over here says, or seems to indicate a bimus, is a platform on which they worship things. Anything that was placed on the bimus was considered to be significant, and therefore they were worshiping it. it's as if you go up to the temple, and anything that's on the front of the temple or stood up in the temple, that's something they worship. So same thing over here. Anything that's placed up on a bimus is something that's worshipped. So they found it on a bimus. It's a hand or a foot on a bimus, and that's why they think it's problematic, is because it's found in a location where people worship. Baal Tosafot don't love that explanation because the Mishnah says, Hamotzei, if you find. And Hamotzei seems to indicate that you happened across this item. If it's found on a bimus, you don't just happen across the item. A bimus is a specific location, and only in that location would it be problematic because of where it's placed. And so they don't like the way that Rashi explains it for that reason. And rather they say bimus means the base of the statue. That's the way that it's translated by the Rabbeinu Chananel. That they are standing on their base. The kan, in this week's parsha, you have the kior, the kano. The kior is the washing basin. Kano is the base upon which the washing station sits. So this you could see, actually, if you go up to places like Caesarea and the amphitheaters there, they have huge amounts of statues and old pieces of things. They don't have the whole statue. You have a base there that has a foot on the base. And then you know it's cracked. So you can see that it was a much bigger statue than that. It's unbelievable, the size of the foot. You can imagine what the size of this statue would have been. But over there, what he's saying is that the foot is placed on a base. There's a difference between a foot that is just found, that you have of a statue, versus a foot that is on a platform or a base. It's on a pedestal of some sort. Not necessarily a worshiping pedestal, but a pedestal means, was it made this way to start with? And that's what the significance of the Bisisan over here is. You could think, and that's what the Baal Tosafot would say over here, that this is Beit Moshav Rachav. It is a base that's wide. Shoshvim alav levadam. They're sitting there alone. Veinam nirim kishvarim. They don't look like they're broken. Not like what I said, like they found up in Caesarea, where it's a piece of a foot that's clearly broken off a larger statue. But they look like a whole foot that is just on this base. That this was made originally in this way. You have a pedestal or a base that has a foot or a hand on it, and that's it. That's all that's on the base. Doesn't look like it's cracked. Doesn't look like there's anything wrong with it. That's why it's a problem. That's interesting only because the Mishnah terms them as shvarim, and then the second half of the Mishnah is matzat tavnit yared tavnit rega. You would have thought that that was a continuation of the first half of the Mishnah, shvarim, but shvarim of tavnit yad v'regel are problematic. The way the Baal Tosafot are explaining it, it's not that way. Shvarim in the beginning of the Mishnah, then you have tavnit yad v'regel is totally independent statement. It's not a broken piece. It's a whole piece. Even that, you would have been questionable had it not been for the fact that they're on a base or a pedestal, which indicates that that was the way it was made. And that means that there's something significant about this foot or this hand. And therefore, they are worshiping to this foot or this hand. Again, it could have been in the hand of another statue. It could have been some sort of significant item to them. And therefore, we consider it to be avodah zarah. And that's why it's problematic. All right, so now we have a machloket. And then we'll go back to the Baal Tosafot in the previous amud, which is Itmar. Avodah tekovim shenishtabra me'eleha. You have avodah zarah that collapsed of its own because either the weight, the wind, some sort of fire, something happened that destroyed the avodah zarah. It wasn't done by a human intervention who came and smashed the statue. That would clearly be bitul. That is something where you're nullifying the avodah zarah. Here, the avodah zarah fell apart by itself. How do we view that? Do we view now that the worshippers, by definition, are then going to say this is not real? And they're going to be mevatel it in their heads. Or do we say that only when they actively break it is that a bitul? But when it happens by itself, that's not considered to be bitul. Obviously, it would have to be a situation in which there are numerous passerbys. It can't be that this is in some remote location and then it breaks and nobody knows about it. Is it a question of avodah zarah or not? Because there was nobody there to be mevatel it. You need people passing by enough to take away the significance of avodah zarah. Because they're passing by and they're mevatel in their health, saying this thing is definitely not the thing to worship. Although we're going to see in tomorrow's daf that the Baal Tosafot seem to make it clear that it has nothing to do with how many people pass by, that they're mevatel it, but rather the ikar davar, that it's broken, assumes or presumes that somebody broke it and was mevatel it. And that means even if the majority of the statue is still intact, but there's a piece broken off of it, that's enough already to deem it as it is mevatel. Because somebody actively did that, and that means that this statue is no longer considered to be avodah zarah. That is here in Machloket Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Yochanan Amar Asura. If it breaks by itself, it retains the status of avodah zarah. Shemalakish Amar Muteret is totally fine. Yochan Amar Asura Dal Lo Bitla. He never was Mivatalit. He didn't do anything active to Mivatalit. When he's smashing it, it's clear that he's nullifying. When it falls apart by itself, he doesn't change his view of the item. It was Avodah Zarah. Now it's broken Avodah Zarah. Meaning, according to Rabbi Yochanan, it's not clear that there was Bitul over here. It could be there was, but we don't know. And ain't Safek Mutsemi Dei Vadai. And that means that if we know for sure it was worshipped, why would you then say it's Mutar if you have no clue as to whether it was or wasn't Mivutal?
We
can assume that that's the way the person thinks about it, because it's what we discussed before. Meimar Amar, he would say, it can't save itself. He's going to speak about himself in the third person. If it can't save itself, he's going to save that man. It's going to save that person. He can't take care of me if he can't take care of himself. And so therefore, it's a stam bitul. Or we can assume that they're going to be mevatalit, because they're going to believe that the powers were taken away from this item, or there is no power to this item. And therefore, in their heads, they say that this is ois avodah zarah. That's machloket here between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. The question is, what's the connection between Shmuel's position on the Mishnah and Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish's position over here? Both of them seem to indicate that when you have broken pieces of Avodah Zarah, that there is now a bitul of the Avodah Zarah. And the Baal Tosfot over here say that the two positions are correlated. It says, Nir Lari, Ki Shmuel Shesover Shivrei Avodat Kochavim Mutarim. He believes that broken pieces of Avodah Zarah are fine. Itlei nami avodat kochavim shenishba me'aleha muteret Rabbi Shimon Lakish. He also subscribes to Rabbi Shimon Lakish, Rabbi Shimon Lakish's opinion, stam avodah zarah, when it breaks by itself, is considered to be bitul. Rabbi Shimon Lakish, to kamar avodat kochavim shenishba me'aleha muteret, when he said that's muteret, itlei nami, he also agrees with Shmuel's position of here, the matzah shivrei avodat kochavim mutarim, vitarvayu chai tama. They both derive from the same reasoning. What it sounds like here is that both of them believe that when you have broken pieces, that's not a avodah zarah anymore. Anything that is broken is already lost any sense or power of avodah zarah, because anybody who sees them is going to be mevatel them, or anytime that it happens, you're going to be stam mevatel them. So he believes that Shmuel, who said in our Mishnah, if you find broken pieces of avodah zarah, it's mutar. That can only be true if you believe that if a statue breaks down by itself, that it's also batel. Because otherwise you could argue that the statue fell apart by itself. So how do you know these pieces are batel? Maybe it's a statue that crumbled by itself. There was an earthquake and it crumbled. How do you know it's batel? The only way you can make a definitive statement that there's a fake sfeika here is to say that anytime you see broken piece of avodah zarah, it's batel. That's whether the guy broke it, or that's whether it happened by itself. So that's the meaning behind Shmuel's statement of the Mishnah. And vice versa. Reish Lakish, who says that avodah zarah that falls apart by itself, then by definition, when you find pieces of avodah zarah, you can assume that that avodah zarah is batel. It can only happen one of two ways. Somebody broke it, or it broke by itself. Either way, it's going to be mutar. Says, if you're looking at percentage-wise, you have to look now. There are three different possibilities over here about why the avodah zarah was destroyed. It was either destroyed by the goy who worshipped it, fell apart by itself, or a Jew came along and destroyed it. The Jew comes along and destroyed it, it doesn't lose its sense of avodah zarah. He says, well, I'll tell you that in a percentage-wise basis, the first two are much more common than a Jew breaking it. Because if a Jew broke it, not only would he have broken it, he would have also been gonezed. He would have either destroyed it completely from the world, or buried it, or done something to remove the avodah zarah from the world. Because if after you break it, it's still deemed to be avodah zarah, you can't just leave it there. You need to pulverize it, you need to destroy it completely. The fact that it's broken is not a good indication that a Jew was involved with it. It's more likely that it was not a Jew that was involved. And that's why the Baal Tosafot would say you can make an assumption that either it fell apart by itself or a non-Jew broke it, not that a Jew was involved with it. So the Baal Tosafot see these two positions as being integrally connected, and that they both hold of each other's position. Although many Rishonim disagree with this position, the Baal Tosafot, because the Rif actually passes like Shmuel, and Paskins like Rabbi Yochanan. According to the way that Baalei Tosafot lay it out, that would be mutually exclusive, because the positions of Shmuel and Reish Lakish are going hand in hand according to the Baalei Tosafot. So they explain that even Shmuel can hold like Rabbi Yochanan, or does hold like Rabbi Yochanan. And the reason Shmuel says that Shivrei Avodah Zarah Mutarim, even though now according to Rabbi Yochanan, if they broke by themselves, it wouldn't be bitul, that is because of the nature and the way that they're found. They found the broken pieces scattered or dispersed which would indicate that somebody did it, and it just didn't happen by itself. And that's how we know that there's bittul here. So that way you could separate the positions of Shmuel and Rish Lakish, and you could hold like Shmuel, and you could hold like Rabbi Yochanan, and in that way you'd explain the psak of the Rif, who passes like Shmuel and passes like Rabbi Yochanan. Whereas for the Balei Tosafot, those two positions are integrally connected, and if you pass them like Shmuel, you're going to have to pass them like Rish Lakish, and vice versa. So now the Gemara continues and says, Eitvei Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Shimon Lakish. Rabbi Yochanan asks Rabbi Shimon Lakish, is that really true, that when it breaks by itself, people stop worshiping it? What about the story of the Aron that ends up after the Plishtim capture the Aron, after the destruction of Mishkan Shiloh? They have all sorts of problems in their cities because the Aron's there, which they eventually send back into Beit Shemesh and the gifts that they have with it and all the problems that happen in Beit Shemesh. We spoke about that earlier in terms of the psukim that we quoted from it. Here they're speaking about what's happening in the cities of the Plishtim. And one of their gods was the god called Dagon. And it says, one day they awoke in the morning after the Aron was kept in the city, Virosh Dagon, Ushtei Kapot Yadav Krutot, the head of Dagon's cut off, and both of its palms or its hands are cut off, and then they were sitting on the Miftana Bayit. They're sitting there on the threshold in the entranceway. So the Dagon was inside their temple or inside whatever location it was. The Aron there starts to cause problems for them, including their Avodah Zarah starts to fall apart. The head of the Avodah Zarah and the hands of the Avodah Zarah fell and were sitting on the threshold of the house. And then it says, Al Kain, Lo Yitruchu Kohenei Dagon. Therefore, till this day, the priest of Dagon won't step on the threshold on the entranceway because the pieces of Dagon were found there after the Aron was in their city. So they saw that as being something of significance, that the pieces or the Shivrei Dagon were found on the threshold, and they considered that to be Avodah Zarah. So now, according to you, Rish Lakish, when it falls apart by itself, they're going to see how powerless this item is. So why would they continue to worship a Dagon, or more importantly, why would they worship the Miftan, or give significance to the Miftan, the threshold where these items were found, if you believe when it falls apart by itself, that means that the dismissive of the Avodah Zarah, or they ascribe no power to it. So Amar Lo, Misham Raya, that you can't prove anything. Atam, Sheminichim et Dagon, Bobdim et Miftan. It's not that they kept their reverence for Dagon anymore. They started to believe that the threshold of the entranceway had more power. And that means that instead of worshiping Dagon, the idol, they started to worship the Miftan, Damre, because they say, Hoche Shavke Yisrei LeDagon. So the way Rashi interprets Yisrei is the Sar, the ministering angel that was part of the Avodah Zarah. This goes back to an interesting philosophical question about Avodah Zarah. What did people really believe in terms of these statues and worshiping Avodah Zarah? Did they really think they had power? Or did they think of them as medians to getting to other powers that were higher up? And over here you have some concept of that, which is Rashi thinks it's the Sar of Dagon. So there was some ministering angel of Dagon, and they believed that that ministering angel is what gave Dagon its power. And then when the hands and the head of Dagon fell off and landed on the threshold, their assumption, according to Rashi, is that the ministering angel moved onto the Miftan. That's where he placed himself, and that's why they worshipped the Miftan. So according to Rashi, they saw this as the new Dagon, and that the Sar of Dagon actually moved onto the Miftan, and that's why they didn't think Dagon was actually broken, because there was just the Sar moved over to the Miftan, and so Dagon moved along with it. Although other Rishonim simply say that Hachi Shavke Yisarei means that his power was diminished or somehow gone, but then that power was vested in the Miftan now, in the threshold going forward, because the threshold was holding the head and the hands of the Dagon. So it wasn't they were still worshiping Dagon and give reverence to the Miftan. It's actually they switched their allegiances from Dagon to the Miftan because of the fact that the Miftan, either the Sar or the power that was in there, was now relegated to the Miftan, and they look at it as if it was a supplanting, meaning that the Miftan now took over as the power, and they no longer worship Dagon, they worship the Miftan. As Rabbi Yochanan says, Lo Yidruchol ala Miftan means that they saw that place as being holy, but they were still entering in, they were still Kohenei Dagon, they were still worshiping Dagon. So Machloket is whether this Miftan supplanted Dagon or not. According to Rashi, Machloket is whether they still worship the original Dagon, or they saw the Miftan as now embodying Dagon, because that's why its hands and head were on the Miftan. So they ask from our Mishnah, if you find broken pieces of etzelim, are elu mutarim? Hashivrei avodat kochavei masurim. The diuk you would make, the same diuk that we made against Shmuel's position before, they're making against Rish Lakish now. Hashivrei avodat kochavei masurim. That means that the broken pieces of the avodah zarah would be problematic. Lo tei mashivrei avodat kochavei masurim. Don't make that diuk. Ela ema haslamim atzman asurim. Make the diuk that only the shivrei tzlamim are problematic, but that means whole tzlamim, whole statues are asurim. Stama ke Rabbi Meir, and the Stam Mishnah is like Rabbi Meir, so that Rabbi Meir, who believes that all sorts of statues are problematic, that not just Antartot, or not just cases where they worship them, but all statues are problematic, so that he'll be the author of the Mishnah, and that's what it comes to say. Shivrei tzlamim, the broken pieces of the tzlamim, are not problematic, according to Rabbi Meir. But if it's a whole statue, it is problematic. Ah, what about avodat kochavim? Avodat kochavim is the same din, exact same din. V'Rabbi Yochanan, mid Rabbi Meir, nishma lehu l'rabbanan. From Rabbi Meir, let us now extrapolate to the Rabbanan. Lav amar Rabbi Meir tzlamim asurim, shivrei tzlamim mutarim. Just like Rabbi Meir says that statues are problematic, broken pieces are mutarin. The Rabbanon, avodat kochavim nami, hi asura, ushvareha mutarim. So too, for the chachamim, we would extrapolate the same thing, which is say that just like the chachamim believe that it's only problematic when it's avodah zarah, and not when it's a tzelem, that should only be true when it's whole. But if it's broken into pieces, then even the chachamim would agree that it's not problematic. And that would be supportive of Reish Lakish's view over here. So that's how he explains the Mishnah. And there are a number of things to note over here, which is number one, the Rashi and the Balei Tosfot point out that the Gemara could have said, V'nishma l'midah rabbanan atzmam. Why do you have to go to Rabbi Meir and say, oh, this is the way Rabbi Meir views it, and so too the rabbanan view it will parallel that type of structure. V'hu adin l'meimar, the rabbanan nishma l'rabbanan. From the rabbanan themselves, we could have explained this. Da asrei tzlamim sheish b'dan makelot tzipor. They say that tzlamim that have certain images in their hands are problematic. The reason they think they're problematic is because people worship them. And then, hachi shivrei mutarim. The next mission says that broken pieces of those statues that the chachamim think are avodah zarah are mutarim. V'hai d'lo kamar hachi. Why does the Gemara medayik that way in support of Reish Lakish? Yishom d'lo chazina behedja matnita and the koshari shivrei otan tzlamim shein asurim. It's not clear that the next Mishnah is referencing back to the previous Mishnah. We have Rabbi Meir makes a statement about tzlamim in general. Then we have the chachamim saying tzlamim are not problematic except if they have this. Then the next Mishnah says shivrei tzlamim. Which tzlamim are they referring to? It's clear that they are modifying Rabbi Meir from the previous Mishnah. It is not clear that they are modifying the Rabbanan. The Rabbanan who say those items are tzlamim are problematic, that's because they think they're avodah zarah. So it's not clear when we say shivrei tzlamim afterwards that that's a reference back to the chachamim's position. So even though technically you could have been medayek from the Chachamim against Rabbi Yochanan, nevertheless, the Gemara did not bring that because that's less explicit. With Rabbi Meir, it's very explicit. He thinks Tzlamim are Sarim, Shivrei Tzlamim are Mutarim. So for the Chachamim who think that Tzlamim are fine, and it's Avodah Zarah that is problematic, then they should believe also that Shivrei Avodah Zarah are fine in paralleling that position of Rabbi Meir. Gemara says, what do you mean? How can you compare the position of the Chachamim to that of Rabbi Meir? Hotam imar abdum imar lo abdum. Even Rabbi Meir agrees that it's not certain that they worship the statues. He's choshish that they might have worshipped the statues because he has a practice in his neighborhood where everybody worships these statues once a year. So then he extrapolated that and said, we're going to worry about other statues. But there's still uncertainty. By every statue, there's an uncertainty whether they worshipped or not. So from there, once they're broken, you have a sfeik sfeika, and that's why he is matir. Imtim tzalo abdum. Even if they worship them, imar bitlum, that they wipe them out, or they nullify them, and therefore it's gone. That's the sfeik sfeika. Avodat kochavim, when you're dealing about a avodah zarah itself, vaday avdua. They definitely worshipped it, meaning imar debitla. Who says that he ever nullified it, that he ever dismissed the avodah zarah? Avay safek vivadai. You have a vadai that they worshipped it, it's absolutely certain they worshipped it, and it's safek whether he's mevatel it. You can't have a safek now undermine a vadai. A safek can undermine another safek and give you a safek safek on Golda Kula. But safek can't be mutzimidei vadai, and therefore it's not a question on Rabbi Yochanan, because the Chachamim's position does not necessarily derive from Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says, if it's whole, it's problematic. If it's broken, it's not. You can't extrapolate that to the Chachamim's position and say if it's whole, it's problematic. If it's broken, it's not. Because the whole of Rabbi Meir is very different than the whole of the Chachamim. The whole of Rabbi Meir is a Safei. The whole of Chachamim is a Vadai. The question that was asked on Rish Lakish, once Rish Lakish explained the Mishnah that it stumped Rabbi Meir, then we said, let's extrapolate from Rabbi Meir's position to the Chachamim's position, and then it would become a question on Rabbi Yochanan. And the answer is, Rabbi Yochanan doesn't have to believe in that extrapolation because the Chachamim's position could be very different than that of Rabbi Meir based on what we just laid out over here. The Baal Tosafot point out that we can't answer here like we answered before. That the Seifa is the reason that we wrote it this way. Because that answer only works according to Rabbi Meir, who's Asar Stam Slamim. But according to the Rabbanon, the question still exists as to why the Gemara made that distinction. And the answer of the Gemara here is, don't set it up like Rabbanon. Use the Mishnah to be Midayik that it's like Rabbi Meir. Now it's established that it's Rabbi Meir, then you could have possibly used this answer. And the Baal Tosafot say the Gemara didn't use that answer because they think it's a dochak. It's not the strongest answer that you could have given. And therefore they try an alternative way to answer the problem without going down that path. So now the Gemara challenges that principle. Be'ein safek motzei midei vadai? Is that really true that a safek cannot undermine a vadai? As the Baal Tosafot point out, the Gemara's question about ein safek motzei midei vadai is not just a question in general about safek and vadai, but rather, that's the question. Here you have a safek, which is a high percentage chance. It's definitely not a low probability case, and it might even be better than 50-50 that this safek will come true. And that's the nature of the Gemara's question. And you have a safek that's a high likelihood to happen, can't that be motzi midei vadai? Like we have examples, and that's what the Gemara is about to bring. But it's not a general statement about the concept of safek motzi midei vadai, because the Baal Tosafot will point out that even a safek isur can't be motzi midei vadai heter, because we have a principle, ain't safek motzi midei vadai. So Gemara is not questioning the principle, they're questioning the application of the principle in these instances. Vatanyo, don't we have a braita? Chaver shemet, a person who's a chaver, which means that he keeps up all the dinim of masrot, tumot, tumah, tara, he passed away. V'niach miguram le'a perot, and he left a storehouse full of fruits, even if they were just picked that day, we assume that they all sure had shumot and masrot taken off of them. Tosafot brings the qualification of the Yushalmi that we're speaking about someone who passed away in a normal manner, not someone who suddenly was killed or something happened to him suddenly, so that he had yishuvadat. He was of sound mind when he passed away, and therefore he took care of matters before he passed away. Va'acha, devadai tefilei. We know for sure that they have tevel associated with them. Safek asrinu, safek lo asrinu. We don't know whether there was trumot masro taken off of them or not. Begate safek umotzi midei vadai. And even though it's a safek whether they took it off or not, we still say that they are musarim, even though they're vadai tevel. Hatam vadai vivadai hu. Over there, it's a certainty on both sides. The vadai asrinu, he definitely took off trumot masro. Kidrabi chanina choza. We have this principle that a chaver will never let anything leave his hand, or he'll never leave anything at risk that other people could trip off on and not take off Trumot HaMasrot. As soon as there's a chiyuv Trumot HaMasrot, he takes care of it right away so as to ensure that nobody has a problem with his fruits. People he knows will assume that he's done it, and then he'll get into trouble. So you know that if you make a simcha, and everybody believes that you keep a certain standard of kashrut, so then they come to the simcha, they don't ask about what the hashkacha is, because they assume that this person has a certain level of kashrut. So then if you decide to go ahead and be makyo in this situation, or take a lower standard, you're going to hurt the people who are making assumption based on your previous practices, and they're going to be in trouble. So same thing over here. The chaver knows people rely on him to take off Trumot HaMasrot. That means if he leaves something without Trumot HaMasrot taking off of it, then he is putting those people at risk. So he never leaves anything because he knows people are relying on him to do such. And therefore it's a vadai vadai. Vibai tema, safek v'safeku. It's actually both a safek. Efshar davad ki Rabbi Shaya. Possible that they did like Rabbi Shaya. Damar, ma'arima damal tfuato, machnisa b'motshila. If a person wants to be a little cunning and make sure that he's not chayav in Trumot HaMasrot, he can bring in the grains while they're still in the husks. So this animal could eat it, and he'd be patur from maser. That is because the chiyuv b'truma maser requires two stages in order to be chayav. The first stage is the processing in the field, which you have to be dash, you have to thresh it, and then you have to do meruach hakri. You have to put it up into a pile. That brings you to the first stage. That first stage makes it that you are asur b'achilat keva, but still mutar b'achilat arai. There's a second stage, which is called riat pnei abayit. Is that when you bring it into the house. That's what eventually makes you chayav in trumot ma'asrot midoraita. That's assuming that you're going to bring it into the house. If after you do the work in the field, you're going to commercially sell it, then they've already become chayav in trumot ma'asrot in the field. Once you do miruach hakri, as soon as you finish the processing in the field, you're then chayav in trumot ma'asrot. But if your intent is to use it for yourself and to bring it into the house, the chiyuv trumot ma'asrot min haTorah only devolves once it's brought, riyat b'nei abayit, once you brought it into the house. So what you need here are two stages in order for it to be chayav in trumot ma'asrot midoraita. The first is you have to do the processing in the field. After it's processed in the field, you have to bring it into the house. Those two items together combine to make you chayav deoraita to take off trumot ma'asrot, or basically make it tevel deoraita. So what you could do, and this is the suggestion of Rabbi Yoshaya, is instead of processing it in the field and then bring it into the house, bring it into the house unprocessed. If you bring it into the house unprocessed with the husk still on it before you've threshed it, then there won't be a chiyuv trumot and masrot on the item. The question of how good a suggestion is a machloket as to whether this is effective to wipe out completely the need for the hafrashat trumot and masrot. It means it's totally patur, and that means that a person can eat from it or an animal can eat from it. Or is it only somewhat successful, which is it continues to give you the right to use it be'arai, but not achilat keva. And that the Gemara defines in other places that achilat be'ima, the eating of an animal, is always defined as arai. It's always defined as being something temporary. So you could argue over here that this statement of Rabbi Shaya, who says that when you do it this way, your animal can eat from it, that means that you still asur for a person to eat from it. It just helps you that you're allowed to have an achilat arai, and a be'ima is an achilat arai, and that's why you can feed your be'ima. Other Rishonim suggest that it's so successful that even a person can eat from it. So then why does he get the example of feeding the behema? Because it's grain and it's husks. Grain and it's husks, people don't eat. That's what animals eat. It's animal feed, not for human consumption. And that's why they give the example of feeding it to your animal. But in Okhanami, you can eat it even without trumot and masrot taken off of it. But that means here that there's a possibility that this grain never became chayav in trumot and masrot. And if that's the case, then it's a safek tevel, safek mi'usar. And then you can have a safek motzi midei safek. What you've now done is taken away the vadei aspect of it, that it's vadei tevel, and say maybe it's safek tevel because he has the option to do it in a way that he would not be chayav in trumot and masrot. It's an interesting, the Gemara here and in Beitza and other places all have this suggestion that it's brought in it. And in each of these cases, it bothers me, and I know the Gemara itself doesn't ask this, which is, if he's a chaver, who is this upstanding religious individual who takes off trumot and masrot, why is he doing this underhanded manner in order to save himself from having to take off trumot and masrot? It seems counter to the persona that is the chaver for him to act in this way. Maybe he does it because it's animal feed, not sure, but it's interesting. We're going to assume that he might have done this in order to free the grains of any obligation to take off trumot and masrot. There are others also who suggest that if you look at the example of the Braita says peirot. Whereas Rabbi Oshaya is clearly speaking about tvuah. And therefore, you might have a difference here between peirot and tvuah. Peirot are only chayav and trumot and masrot midrabanan, whereas tvuah is chayav and trumot and masrot midoraita. And that might explain why Rabbi Oshaya says you can only eat achilat arai from it, whereas the Braita we brought before seems to suggest that you could eat from it without any problem whatsoever. That might be because the safek that you have there is a safek derabanan. But Rabbi Shai was speaking about tvuah, they were speaking about something that's tevel midoraita. Once you speak about tevel doraita, that's why it's still a sur for human consumption, it's only mutar for the behema. And what they're all trying to understand is, why does Rabbi Shai have a different outcome than the Braita? The Braita says it's totally mutar afterwards, and Rabbi Shai says you can feed it to your animal. So there are two ways to explain that, either again the difference between peirot and tvuah, or the other way is to say that eino chanami, even Rabbi Shai agrees that the human can eat it. It's just that when grain is in its husks, that you feed the animals, you don't feed the human beings. But he would agree that someone could eat it if they wanted to. If they roll it afterwards and take off the husks, they could eat it themselves. Or there is a third opinion, which is that Rabbi Oshaya's din is only matir achilat arai or achilat behemto, and there's still an isur d'rabanan, and along comes the chazokah that ein chaver motzi mitachat yodo davar sheinu mitukan, and that chazokah overrides the din d'rabanan. And that's why in the Braita you get a heter gamur, but it's built on top of Rabbi Oshaya that has an isur d'rabanan, and then the chazokah is able to overcome that problem d'rabanan. Vein safek motzi midei vadai. The Gemara says again, are you so sure that a safek can't undermine a vadai? Batanya, we have a bright Amar Rav Yehuda Masse b'shivchato shel mitzik echad berimon. There was an incident with this maidservant of a mitzik. Now, the translation of mitzik, Rashi says, is gavra alma. It is a strong man. This is a person who got his way by force. As the Balei Tosfot was quoted, he's an anas, person who forces people to do things, or confiscates people's property. It was not a nice guy. Ubatosefta, he said, garos mosek. Not a mitzik, but a mosik. A mosik is an olive picker. So he had olive orchards, or he was a person that processed olives. That'd be a nicer way to go about it in the story. So the question whether he's a mitzik or a mosik over here. Shetila nefel lebor. This maidservant of this individual, she had a miscarriage of sorts that went into a pit. Uba koein, a koein probably on the haaretz, came along and looked over the cistern in which this was done. Beitzitz leyeda. And he looked in to know im zachari nikeva. Was it a male or a female to know how much tuma this woman has associated with her? By the way, this goes back to what we see many times. If you think the girsa over here is mitzik, that he's a problematic, oppressive type of individual, yet he's worried about tuma vetara. Here he wants to know whether this shifcha has a din of tuma tara, does she need to bring a korban? All these things that come about with it, religiously, he's very religious. But Ben Adam Lechavero, he's somebody who uses force to get his way. That inconsistency or contradiction, we find, unfortunately, many times in the Gemara, and even in the modern era, where people, Ben Adam Lemakom, are very religious, but Ben Adam Lechavero, they're not so careful. That would be example of this. Ellen Kane, if you say like the Gears of the Valley Tosafot, then none of that would be meaningful, because it'd be a mosaic, it'd be just like a regular guy. But now, he looked over. Obama said, if nei chachamim itiaru, the incident came to the chachamim, and they said that this kohen is tor. Ipnei shukhuda bardalas mitzuim sham. Because there are weasels and other rodents that are there that come and eat these items, and they would have taken it away into their hole, they would have eaten it already. Va'achad avade itila, nefel. We know for sure she miscarried the nefel, which would be tamei. Safek garua, safek lo garua. And there's a chance the animal pulled it away into his hole and took it away, and there's a chance he didn't take it away. And the Chachamim said he was tahor. And they're saying the safek's enough to get rid of the vadai. So lo tema itila nefel lebor. It's not that she miscarried a nefel, something that already has the form of a human being, into the bor. Elema itila kemin nefel lebor. She had a miscarriage of something that went into the bor. Valeidain zachar nekevahu tani. Says he wanted to know if it was male or female. Well, if you don't even know if it's a nefel, why do you need to know if it's male or female? Hachi gamar. The kohen amaritz that went to look here, leda im ruach epila, im nefel etila. The first thing he wants to do is check if it was a nefel or not a nefel. So if it is a nefel, then you have to go on and discuss with it zachar nekeva. It's not a nefel, you would have been tahor to start with. Bimtim salomar nefel etila, if you think it was a miscarriage of a form that's already enough to be considered a birth, like dying zachar nekeva, to figure out it was a zachar nekeva. So it's actually a safek here to start with. There is a safek as to whether there is a nefel here which would have tumat leida associated with it, or there's something that's called a ruach ipila. It's something too earlier in its formation stage that's not considered to be a leida, and there's no tuma over here. So that's the first question. After you answer that question, there's a secondary question. If it is a nefel, is it a zachar nekeva? That means that you have a safek, whether there's actually something tamei down there, and also a safek of a bardalus or chulda taking it away. So a safek can be motzi mitei safek. V'ibaydeima, kevin shechulda bardalus mitzuin sham vaday garua. There are others that say that a bardalus and a chulda, it's so certain that they would eat something like this, or take it away, that you could assume it's not there. It's like a vaday, being motzi mitei vaday. Again, the Gemara tried to challenge this concept that ain't safek motzi mitei vaday. The answer to the Gemara again is, it's either a safek, motzi midei safek, or Vadai Motzi Midei Vadai, but we're not speaking about here, it's a fake that it's Motzi Midei Vadai. Over here, the Baalei Tosafot make a number of assumptions about the case here. The first of which is, they had to know that the boar was already empty before she miscarried in it. And he suggests over here that this was a miscarriage boar. Meaning that it was a place where women went to miscarry, and therefore it was commonly checked because they wanted to make sure that there wasn't tumah there. And therefore it was empty before she came and miscarried there. Number two is, he says that it either has to be in Rishut Yachid, or you have to say that it's in Rishut Rabim.
In either case, why is there a question over here? Because we have a principle.
Safek Tumah B'Shut Yachid
is Tamei. Safek Tumah B'Shut Rabim is Torah. He gives a number of ways to deal with that. Ibai Dema.
To say that it's in Rishut Rabim, where it's not deep enough. It's a situation in which your head goes over the boar, you cover the whole area of the boar.
So then it doesn't take on that status of Safek Tumah B'Shut Rabim. Ibai Dema. Bevadai Bebor B'Shut Yachid Shamo Piyut. We're dealing with a boar B'Shut Yachid. But we assume that Vadai Graruhu, so therefore there's no Safek over here. Or, he gives a third possibility, is Mairi Bibor, the Kaimi Bishut Yachid, Ragle Kohen Bishut Rabim. That the Kohen is in Rishut Rabim, the Bor is in Rishut Yachid. So you really have a Safek here that straddles Rishut Yachid and Rishut Rabim, and that's why it's not automatically Safek Bishut Yachid or Safek Bishut Rabim.
And the third assumption here, which as we pointed out, is that a Shivcha is Mitameh Baleida. That a Shivcha Knanit would have the din of Tumat Leida, like a regular Israelite, even though she is a Shivcha. And he says that there's a correlation between Brit Milah and Tumat Leida. And we know that the child born to a Shivcha Knanit has to get a Brit Milah on the eighth day. And so therefore, Viz Chayav in Brit Milah, that's also indicative of the fact that his mother is Tamei Tumat Leida. And that's another assumption in the case. And Baalei Tosafot will point out, Oto Kohen Shotehaya. This was a Kohen Amaretz because he went ahead and looked over in order to figure this out, taking a huge risk that he was going to become a Tamei. Because you're not allowed to be Tamei yourself to figure these things out. So Rashi has a slightly different version of that and says that it was a Kohen, doesn't mean a Kohen. Kohen here means a general term for a Chacham. It's a wise person went and did it. Rashi doesn't take the word Kohen literally, because what Kohen would make himself Tamei for something silly like this? And that's why he had to get a psak, it's whether he was Tamei or not Tamei, and whether he needed to become Tohor. Alright, we're gonna stop here. 12 lines down on the top of Membet Amud Aleph.